from KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. The Trump administration separated potentially thousands more migrant children from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border than previously thought. That's according to a new report by the Office of the Inspector General. The report found that the administration's tallies did not include children who were separated and detained before June of 2018, when a court order forced the government to keep count. We look into that report. But first, BuzzFeed is reporting that President Trump directed his former attorney Michael Cohen to lie about the Moscow Trump Tower project, a revelation that Democrats say, if true, are among the most serious to date. So we're going to dig into both of these things with politics reporters Marisa Lago. She's a reporter at KQED's California Politics and Government Desk and co-host of KQED's Political Breakdown podcast. Hi, Marisa Lagos.
Hey, Mina.
And we're also joined by Jessica Taylor. She's a political reporter for NPR. Good morning, Jessica Taylor.
Good morning.
So, Jessica, Democratic lawmakers are saying they'll investigate the BuzzFeed News report that President Trump directed Michael Cohen to lie to Congress about what was happening around his Trump Tower project during the 2016 campaign. Can you just quickly tell us what the BuzzFeed report is alleging?
So it is alleging that he asked Cohen to lie to Congress about these negotiations to build a Trump Tower in Moscow, and you know that he wanted to also travel during the presidential campaign to meet Putin personally. And so this whole timeline is sort of what is getting at, because Trump has previously said he did not have any business ties in Russia. He was not pursuing this. Cohen has now, and others have now come forward and saying that is incorrect, that they were trying to actively build a Trump Tower there while the presidential campaign was going on. And so if he had directed Cohen to lie under oath to Congress, these are very serious allegations that have been the basis for previous impeachment claims against Nixon and against Clinton. And this is probably one of the most serious things to date. You know, of course, Democrats newly in power, now in control of the House with subpoena power and investigation and investigative power. I mean, they are pouncing all over this. But, you know, Republicans in large part have still remained behind him. And while there may be the votes in the House for impeachment, and you have even some more progressive lawmakers pushing for that, of course, in order to convict, it requires a majority in a two-thirds majority in the Senate that is not there yet, given the Republicans still control it. And so, you know, what this comes out, it also shows, the BuzzFeed report also says that Special Counsel Robert Mueller has a lot of these texts and emails and different things from the Trump Organization. So that is potentially a minefield. You know, I think the real test is, when does this Mueller report come out? How much of it is made public? And is that something that could change Republicans' mind as they continue to stand behind Trump?
Yes. Well, let's dig into some of the overview, Marisa Lagos, that Jessica Taylor just gave us. And we should note that BuzzFeed is saying that they got this information from two law enforcement officials. But we should note that KQED, we have not confirmed this report ourselves. But first, she mentioned how Democrats are pouncing all over this. How many of them are bringing up the I word, impeachment?
Well, I think that Democrats are, you know, at least the ones within the leadership structure, are being very careful, right? They don't want it to look like a witch hunt, as the president says. And so what we've seen from Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell, for example, from the California delegation, who are on the Intelligence Committee, is saying that they are absolutely going to investigate this, that if it's true, it, of course, is a very serious matter. You know, I think we'll hear sort of more extreme statements from the wing of the party. But I think, you know, Pelosi and the people close to her know that there's a big task in front of them. There's a lot of like ways these investigations could go. And I think what they're trying to do is probably focus on the most concrete and serious allegations. And I think, to Jessica's point, this is certainly one of both.
And Jessica, you were saying that Republicans are still largely with him. I mean, is it too soon to say whether or not the ripple effect of this will lead some Republicans to distance themselves from the president? Or do you think they will continue enabling him?
I think it's too soon to say, because predictably, you have a lot of Republicans saying these are, you know, unnamed sources, and they will call things fake news, certainly. And, you know, Trump this morning has tweeted, you know, kind of trying to imply something about Michael Cohen and his father-in-law, which is unclear. And, you know, Cohen himself, you know, has admitted to lying to prosecutors. And so they're saying, you know, he's untrustworthy. I think that, I mean, a big day coming up in early February, Cohen is going to testify on Capitol Hill. And that is, I think, going to be must-watch television. And what he could reveal there, I mean, it certainly feels like it kind of harkens back to, you know, those Watergate hearings in a way. But I think that a lot of Republicans... Also, I think it also remember we're in the midst of a partial government shutdown.
Yes,
there's also so many other things going on in Washington that while this is a big deal, there are like five other big deals happening right now as well. So it is still hard, as much of a bombshell story as this is, for it to somewhat break through.
Yes. And we want to get to some of those other big deals very soon. But quickly, Jessica Taylor, what has been the president's reaction to this?
So we have had Kellyanne Conway has gone on, and you know she's tried to downplay it, and right now, I mean, they're not essentially denying it in a way. I don't believe that we have not seen that yet. There have been a lot of statements that have been coming out even as I've been sitting here. I think that most of the emphasis this morning are questions about Pelosi's travel and different things. And so the White House, I think that, you know, I will note too, you know, we had Trump's tweets this morning. He was tweeting about caravans, which is something that he did in the midterms, you know, just sort of deflect and things too. So it doesn't seem like the White House really wants to talk about this. Of course, they'd rather talk about immigration and the wall and the shutdown. And that's sort of par for the course that we have seen from them.
Well, you were mentioning other big things going on at the White House, and I do want to get at the administration, and I do want to get to also just how things will go for the shutdown when you have this tit-for-tat between Nancy Pelosi and President Trump. But first, I really do want to look at this report from the Department of Health and Human Services, just because it's so alarming, even though in some ways it confirms what a lot of people have been suspecting and reporting, that thousands more children were separated from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border than previously thought, because these were children before the zero-tolerance policy was announced. Marisa, can you tell us a little bit about how this happened?
Well, so according to this government watchdog report, for nearly a year, thousands of migrant children, we don't have an exact amount, were being separated. And you know, I think that this is, I mean, it's interesting because what the Department of Homeland Security is saying about it is that it vindicates what DHS has been saying, that, quote, for more than a decade, it was and continues to be standard for apprehended minors to be separated. You know, I think that clearly this wasn't a policy that they came out at the time and talked about. And I think when you see the blowback that ultimately occurred, it's not shocking. But it raises so many questions about what happened to those kids, because
yes,
we have courts who have interceded in what we know about happening in 2018. But if this was going on for a full year before that, where are those parents? Did they get deported? Are their kids here? Were they even attempted to be reunited? I mean, I think that there's going to be a lot more of investigation that comes out of what we know now.
And just to remind our listeners, the government said that there were about 2,700 children separated
right
from their parents. And now we're hearing that it could be thousands more on top of that because, you know, potentially up to a year before the zero tolerance policy was announced, there was almost some reporting that the separations, Jessica Taylor, were like a trial balloon. Marisa raised an interesting point about, you know, can we at least be reassured that those people who were released before the zero tolerance policy, that they went to relatives or safe people, Jessica Taylor?
I mean, it certainly doesn't seem like that. And I think there are questions raised in this report about, you know, the tracking that they were doing, the paperwork that they were doing, the, you know, sort of due diligence that they were doing in a way. And so these all, I think, sort of bolster these claims and raise real questions about how they are keeping these children. And like Marisa said, you know, about how they are, you know, what kind of facilities and different things too, we continue to have questions about. And, you know, remember that we have now had two children that have died while in custody,
yeah,
as well. And so I think that there's a lot more questions that this report answers. But I think, you know, those of us who have been following this, it probably doesn't come as much of a shock that there were more children than initially reported.
Yes. And just the idea of thousands, but not ever really ever knowing how many. I mean, how can we have a government that pulls kids from adults or parents and not know for sure how many there were and exactly what happened to them. I'm going to put out our number to our listeners to get their reaction to these two big stories. The number here, 866-733-6786, if you have thoughts or questions for our political reporters. Again, 866-733-6786. Post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, on Facebook, tweet us at KQED Forum, or email us at forum@kqed.org. We're talking about how BuzzFeed is reporting that the president directed his former longtime attorney, Michael Cohen, to lie about the Moscow Trump Tower project. We're looking at how government inspectors say now thousands more migrant children were separated at the border by the Trump administration than previously reported. And Marisa Lagos, is anyone being held accountable for this now? Now that this, you know, IG report has come out, will there be any movement to try to hold someone responsible for all of this?
Well, I think this goes back to what we were talking about before, which is the fact that we do have a divided Congress. And I think you can expect to see the House dig into this and probably investigate again. I mean, these are the kinds of sort of concrete issues that I think Pelosi and Democrats in the House of Representatives feel that they have a duty to look into, and that it's not just some, like, you know, political football. You know, I think on the Senate side, there will be questions. We have seen in some cases, you know, some bipartisan questioning of Secretary Nielsen, the DHS secretary. But, you know, I don't think that people who are critical of these policies and what's happened over the past couple of years with these children, I don't think would say that, you know, the Senate has really dug in and held the administration's feet to the fire on this. You know, I think that the fact that we had confirmation hearings for a new attorney general this week sort of is an interesting twist, in the sense that Bill Barr does not seem to be quite as much of an immigration hardliner as Jeff Sessions, but still pretty, you know, in that model. And Sessions, you know, just came from such a different place in terms of that had been so much his issue for so long. Barr has a long history in law enforcement. Sessions, I think, came from a more political place. But if you listen to those hearings, I mean, that was the part of his testimony that I think troubled Democrats the most, was his sort of agreeing with just some of the premise of the way the administration has presented what's happening at the border. And so I think that vote, you know, this could impact that vote as well.
Well, Marisa Lagos is a reporter with KQED's California Politics and Government Desk, and we're also talking with Jessica Taylor, political reporter for NPR. And with you, our listeners, let's start with Bonnie in Santa Rosa. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi there.
Go ahead, Bonnie.
Hello?
Yes, you're on.
Yeah, boy, there's so much, isn't there? But I did have a question maybe people can address. I read the BuzzFeed article last night online, and, you know, it's kind of difficult when they cite these unnamed sources, but do these two law enforcement officials, does this represent perhaps the first leak in the Mueller investigation?
Jessica Taylor, do you want to take that?
You know, Mueller's investigation, when it started, he's someone who, you know, runs a tight ship. And we have seen, I think, certainly less leaks. And I know talking with our justice correspondents and things too, one of the first things they noted when he was appointed, they said, you know, this is going to be a, you know, very leak-free investigation. And it largely has been that. There have been reporting outside of things probably. But, you know, if this is coming from within, I also think it could signal that, you know, it's becoming very close to him probably releasing his report in a way as well.
Yeah, and calls are increasing for that.
Yeah. And I do want to provide one update that I just got across Twitter, that Rudy Giuliani, of course, the former New York City mayor who was acting as a spokesman and a legal counsel for Trump on this matter, he has now denied this, saying any suggestion from any source that the president counseled Michael Cohen to lie is categorically false. Michael Cohen is a convicted criminal and liar. And it's pointing to those, you know, that he himself, Cohen, is going in for jail time as well. And so, you know, I think that a lot of this, it could be proven true with the Mueller report, which I do think, you know, sort of maybe these drips that we are getting seems to signal that something could be imminent. But in Washington, imminent certainly isn't tomorrow or next week or things either necessarily.
Yes, but the suggestion that Cohen's a liar, but yet Cohen is saying he was directed to lie, that's what is sort of ironic about all of that. But bringing up William Barr earlier, Marisa Lagos, you were saying that you know, the separations could put some pressure on Barr to take the situation more seriously at the border. But what about, you know, concerns about how squishy he was in terms of releasing the Mueller report to the public? Could this change that if it's found to be, you know, a credible story by BuzzFeed.
I mean, it's so hard to know, right? Like, I mean, the news just moves so quickly. If you look at the what we've learned just in the past month or so about the Russia investigation between Manafort and Cohen, I think part of the problem politically for Democrats on that sort of question is that it almost moves so fast. It's like hard to keep up. You forget the last bombshell revelation. I mean, things that would have potentially taken down other presidents sort of are just like in the course of business these days. So I think it's hard to ever know exactly how one part of this story is going to impact another. But, you know, I think that Barr is certainly, again, coming from a different place as sort of a lifelong law enforcement official. I think that Democrats who are maybe still considering voting for him or said that they would took some solace in that, but not a ton, because, you know, on those issues, there was a little bit of ambiguity there.
And I will say, having watched some of the Barr hearing this week, I mean, I think we were expecting maybe some more bombshells, especially because on the Judiciary Committee, there are senators that are considering running for president and things too. But it was largely just sort of a normal confirmation hearing, which
totally.
We don't get a lot of normal in Washington these days. And for Democrats, probably this is probably the best nominee that they could hope for, because he's someone that you would see in any sort of normal Republican administration other than Trump's being put out there. You know, he has this background in the Bush administration and is not a particularly political figure. Yes, some of his writings and things on special counsels have come under scrutiny and different things and like that. But I mean, as Marissa mentioned, you know, he is not someone that's like this firebrand person like Jeff Sessions was. And also one of the things they focused on too, he is very good friends with Bob Mueller. I mean, like, yeah, he went to his daughter's weddings and I think that they've had dinner together and things too. So I mean, this is someone that clearly he trusts as well and has a respect for.
Well, let's go to more of our listeners' calls. Bruce in Piedmont, you're on. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. Yes, you know, you mentioned correctly that this is just two of a large number of outrageous things, and they happen every day. When you extract out and don't consider the outrages that have to do with partisan political policy, there are differences of policy. There are still so many outrageous things that are threats to our national security. And I'd like our correspondents to explain, what are the Republicans thinking? Why do they ignore these time after time after time?
Bruce, thank you. Marisa Lagos, do you want to respond to Bruce? It's hard to ever get into the minds of people, but
yeah, what are the Republicans thinking? I mean, I think that the sort of common wisdom is that they are nervous about their base. That, you know, again, we've seen Trump's base really stick with him regardless of what happens. And we've also seen the president repeatedly jump in and help primary Republicans who do go against him. And so I think that there's still you know, this caution. I think that with 2020 around the corner and the change of power, the balance of power in the House and some of the senators and the different calculations in terms of which Senate seats are going to be up in 2020, that could change. But again, you know, I think on things like, you know, the shutdown and the fact that you see people like Susan Collins or whatever maybe making comments that they're willing to make a deal, but then not actually going out and doing much about it. There's a lot of questions about how serious even people who are willing to stand up and speak critically about Trump, like whether they'll take that to the next step.
Well, Bruce, thanks for the question. Yes, Jessica Taylor.
Another thing I'd like to point out, too, is typically we have seen past administrations when they sort of get shellacked, as Obama said, in midterm elections in 2010 for him and 2006 for Bush when the House flipped. They take lessons from this, I think. But as I even thought that would happen before the midterms, if Republicans lost the House, that Trump is not going to take those lessons. He is not someone that looks back and says, oh, maybe I should do something different. He barrels down his own path no matter what happens. He thinks he is his best strategist. He has no need for outside advisors. He goes on forward. And Republicans largely have adopted this mentality. And I think that this is the danger going forward into 2020, that they are reading all of the wrong lessons about the midterm elections. And we've seen this, I think, in the shutdown fight. Trump very much campaigned for Republican candidates on the wall on border security. This was sort of his closing message. They lost the House by more seats than we really expected that they were going to. 40 was really an astonishing number, far more than the 23 that they needed. In the Senate, though, they're saying, okay, we still held on to the Senate. But it was such a different map there, where Republicans were almost entirely on offense, and Democrats were defending seats in very, very red places. 2020 is not like that. You have more vulnerable Republicans. And you know, it's sort of he won one election with his base, but we've even had polling out this week from NPR showing that our NPR Marist poll that base is eroding, and that an astounding, very low number of people are inclined to reelect him. And that's something that I think should be a wake-up call for Trump, but I'm not sure that it's going to be.
And again, Jessica Taylor is a political reporter with NPR, and Marisa Lagos is a reporter at KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. And if you want to join the conversation, the number here, 866-733-6786, the email address forum@kqed.org, our website, kqed.org/forum, and we're at KQED Forum on Facebook and Twitter. Marisa Lagos, more about the shutdown and how it is affecting the president's approval numbers. And as Jessica mentioned, we're seeing, you know, some slippage, for lack of a better word, among his hardcore base. So in this tit-for-tat that we saw this week between Speaker Nancy Pelosi and President Trump, with Nancy Pelosi suggesting that he postpone his State of the Union address, Trump postpone his State of the Union address amid the government shutdown, and then Trump firing back by canceling at the very last minute, in quite dramatic fashion, her planned trip to Afghanistan. What does that say about, you know, the length of this shutdown potentially, and also just who will come out on top?
I mean, I think it's really hard to say who will come out on top. And I think that often, you know, these things, again, like, the things move so quickly. We're in early 2019. Will the shutdown be a factor by 2020 when Trump's on the ballot again? Who knows, right?
Historically, it hasn't.
Yeah, I think that if the election was next week, that would be a totally different story. But we did see this morning a new development we should update our listeners on, which is that Pelosi did suggest or did decide to try to fly commercial with this delegation. And now her office is accusing the president of leaking those travel plans. So they did cancel this Afghanistan trip, saying it's too much of a security risk. You don't want to give anyone a heads up when you're going into a combat zone or to visit troops. And I think she tried to be a little careful about saying, well, you know, somebody asked her, you know, are you suggesting that the president did this as payback around the shutdown and the State of the Union thing? And she said, well, I wouldn't suggest that. I don't think, you know, he would do that. So, you know, I think that this is a new moment. Nancy Pelosi is a very different person than Chuck Schumer, for example. She's in a much more powerful position than any Democrat has been since Trump was elected. And, you know, it's hard to say with Trump, like, does this hurt the chances of a deal or make him respect her more and bring everybody to the table? I mean, that may sound a little crazy, but you kind of get the sense that he does have more respect for Pelosi than for some of her counterparts. And, you know, she is a good negotiator. She is very good at keeping her caucus together. And I think that that is sort of the key thing right now for her, which is that if you don't have Democrats kind of peeling off, that you're in a stronger position for these negotiations. But, you know, I think anytime we talk about this, important to mention, who are the victims here? 800,000 workers.
Yes.
Their families. I mean, I heard a heartbreaking story yesterday about a TSA agent saying he was going to have to sell his home because of the shutdown. It's just unfathomable.
And we had a show yesterday just trying to get a sense of how folks in the Bay Area who are federal employees or who rely on federal employees, including contractors, how they're being affected by this. But ultimately, to your earlier point, even if President Trump admires Nancy Pelosi's audacity, let's say, I doubt, would ever want to be seen as capitulating to her,
no.
Which is how these things, this is again being described, Jessica Taylor, as a safe face-saving opportunity. Jessica, I'd like you to take this question from Nathan. Hi, Nathan.
Hey, good morning. How you doing there?
Well, what's on your mind, Nathan?
I feel that with his actions, with Trump's actions, it's almost sometimes, I'm curious if it's intentionally self-destructive, where he can just continue to run this out and just destroy the foundation of Americans, of the 800,000 who don't have money coming in, and then in a sense say, well, you know, it's somebody else's fault. We'll let them take it on if it was to, scary enough, go to another election cycle. So I don't know. He's so hard to read that I wonder if he is self-destructive and disconcerting to the citizens.
And Jessica, you had given an assessment of sort of how Trump runs runs his administration, essentially, in his style. But just to add to Nathan's question, we are at the president's two-year mark this weekend, and he was inaugurated. And so I imagine this is not what he wanted to be the news on his two-year anniversary.
Well, on his one-year anniversary, the government was also in a shutdown. It was a much shorter one. It only lasted for, I think, 3 or 4 days. So we did not see certainly the ramifications that we are seeing now. But I do think it is noteworthy that on both anniversaries of his inauguration, the government has been shut down, at least partially. And, you know, that thing that just says something about the dysfunction that this administration seems to breed in a way. And I've covered I've covered, I think, at least 4 shutdowns now in Washington. Some of them have been, you know, just weekend ones. The one last year, this time, was just a couple of days. There was that 16-day one, rather, I believe, in 2013. This one, I don't know how it ends. I honestly have no idea, because you have Trump saying, I'm not budging, Democrats saying they're not budging. No one seems to want to get to any middle ground, and Democrats very much believe they have the upper hand. Polling is bearing that out. And let's not forget, too, at this point last year, when it seemed like they actually might have made a deal, because Trump came to the table and Schumer and Pelosi came to the table, and they were going to give him $20 million for his wall in exchange for protections for DACA. But Trump then wanted to add reductions to legal immigration and reneged on that deal. And so he could have had his money for his wall a year ago. Democrats were going to give that up then. And so I think this is one reason why they feel like they have the upper hand, because they could go in there and agree to something. Trump could come out and spin it some completely different way, and they could be burned. So, I mean, the problem is, too, I think Democrats don't go in, given some of their past negotiations with him, thinking that this is a good faith effort on his part either.
Well, we just have 30 seconds left, Marisa Lagos, but whenever we look at the week in politics and the events that happen, there's always this lingering question of, has anything happened this week that could signal a potential shift in one direction or the other? Any final thoughts on that?
I mean, I think this Cohen news is really big. And I think that, you know, once we get that Mueller report, if we see it, all of that is going to be huge.
Marisa Lagos, a reporter at KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. Thanks, Marisa.
My pleasure.
And Jessica Taylor, political reporter for National Public Radio. Thanks.
Thank you.
And thanks to our listeners for your questions and comments. Another hour of Forum is next. Stay with us. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.